Are you a follower of Christ? Or are you just a fan? It's a question asked by Kyle Eidelman in his 2011 book, Not a Fan. He writes, "The dictionary defines a fan as an enthusiastic admirer. Fans want to be close enough to Jesus to get all the benefits, but not so close that it requires sacrifice. Fans may be fine with repeating a prayer, attending church on the weekend, and slapping a Jesus fish sticker on their bumpers. But is that really the extent of the relationship Jesus wants? Are we completely committed followers of Christ, or are we just an adult fan club?" While it is no doubt a contemporary issue, it is one that has ancient roots. We've seen the problem appear in our study of John. I think of chapter 6, where Jesus came in Galilee and performed an amazing sign. He multiplied bread, just like Moses. And the result is that people begin to seek him. But not because of the sign, not because it identified him as the new Moses who could lead them on a new exodus into the kingdom. They sought him because their bellies were filled. They weren't interested in who Jesus was, they were interested in what he could do for them. And so when he told them that he wasn't going to do what they wanted him to do, they deserted him. They left him. Even his own disciples left him. He was left with just the 12. And you recall that question he posed to them, "You're not going to leave too, are you?" And Peter's response, "Where could we go, Lord? You have the words of eternal life." With the capture and crucifixion of Jesus, though, even their faith was tested, as we saw in the preceding weeks. And we're left at the end of the story after having witnessed the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, wondering about some of the disciples. Were they committed followers of Jesus? Would they turn out to just be fans? It is an issue that we will encounter in our text today in the final chapter of John, John chapter 21. So if you will meet me there. As you recall, through these number of weeks that we have spent in this text, John's gospel is written to one who needs life, that thing that we all so desperately need. And in order to meet that need, John introduces the reader to Jesus, the life of God in a man. In him is the life, and the life is the light of men. Whosoever believes in him shall not perish, but shall have everlasting life. Whosoever has the Son has this life, because he has the words of life. He is the bread of life. He gives the light of life. He offers abundant life. The variety that goes on and on. The length of days and years of life that we so desperately desire, these things are found in Jesus. And that is why John wrote his gospel, including the signs that he chose, so that we might too believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that through that belief, through that faith, through that trust, we would have life in his name. Last week, we covered what, by all accounts, should have been the conclusion of John's gospel. And yet we find, as we turn the page, that there is another chapter, an epilogue to the story. Why is it here? We will find out. Read with me. John chapter 21, verse 1. After these things, that is, after the resurrection appearance of Jesus to the apostles and to Thomas, after these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, the twin, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee and two others of his disciples were together. And Simon Peter, And Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." And they said to him, "We will also come with you." And they went out and got into the boat. And that night they caught nothing. Time has passed since the resurrection appearance of Jesus following his crucifixion. Exactly how much, we cannot be sure. It would appear that Pentecost had yet to occur. So I'm assuming that we're within 50 days of his crucifixion. And we find this account. And as a reader, I have to ask, why is this scene here? If John's gospel was about proving that Jesus is the Christ so that I, as a reader, can have life in his name, I would think that that goal was completed. It was accomplished with chapter 20 and the resurrection. But here the story keeps going. Why? What do we find in this scene that I need to know? What are the disciples doing? They are fishing. You say, okay. Well, that's not very surprising to me, since I know that the disciples were fishermen, that they were fishermen by trade before they became disciples of Jesus. And so they're fishing. But then I have to ask, what were the disciples supposed to be doing? I know what they are doing. What are they supposed to be doing? From the very beginning of John's gospel, Jesus has been preparing these men for a mission that they have to undertake following his absence, of taking his word to the world. So I think about the miracles that he performed that we read in the text were for their benefit. The disciples saw this. The disciples believed. So I think of the wedding in Cana, when the disciples were with Jesus and they saw him turn water to wine. Or I think of when the disciples were out rowing against the sea and he came and walked on water and presented himself to them. Or I think of the resurrection of Lazarus. Why has he died? Well, this is so that y'all will believe. It's for y'all I'm doing these things. I think of the upper room discourse, those five chapters from chapter 13 to 17 in John, which make up a full quarter of John's gospel. 25% of this gospel is devoted to instruction, where Jesus pulls the disciples aside and he says, "This is what you need to be about when I leave. This is what your purpose is. This is your mission." And now he's gone. And we read about the disciples and they're fishing. You say, okay. So they didn't get right away to spreading the word. They didn't get right away to spreading the gospel. But why do we need to know that? Why is that important? Why is this scene critical for a reader to know? Well, notice who's here. If I'm reading about those that are present, I find them in verse 2 by name: Simon Peter, Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee. And then we have this reference: there are more people there, the sons of Zebedee, two others of his disciples were together. And of course, I need to know that the sons of Zebedee are there because the author of this text is one of the sons of Zebedee. It's John, the disciple who Jesus loved. So I need to know that he was an eyewitness to this. He was there. But I have three given by name. Why? Why are these three named? Well, I think about how these three appeared in the story. What do I know about how Jesus, what he did with these three, or how they appeared? What do they have in common? Well, they're all Jesus' followers. That's true. But they're also all Jesus' doubters. They're all Jesus' doubters. Nathanael, as you recall, at the opening of John's gospel, was incredulous at the thought that anything good could come from Nazareth. Thomas, as we saw last week, refused to believe in Jesus' resurrection without personally experiencing it. Unless, he says, if I put my finger into the holes in his hands and reach into his side, I simply will not believe. And of course, there's Peter, who three times denied association with Jesus right before his crucifixion. The three men that John mentions here are all doubters. A recent Barna study released titled, "What Do We Do with Doubt?" showed that a majority in America are now open into tapping more deeply into their spiritual life. According to an article that previewed the study's results, it said that as of October in 2022, 3 out of 4 U.S. adults, 74%, say they want to grow spiritually. Additionally, the same proportion, 77%, say they believe in a higher power. And nearly half, 44%, say they are more open to God today than before the pandemic. Yet, this curiosity may naturally be accompanied by tough questions, with over half of American adults and teens reporting that they've experienced doubts about their religious beliefs, at least sometime in the past few years. It asks the questions, are churches making space for this reality? Are churches open to dealing with its congregation's doubts? Tim Keller, some of y'all know, is a very famous Christian pastor, preacher, writer, apologist. He deals quite a bit with doubts in some of his writings because some of his primary audience are seeker-related groups. They're those who are interested in Jesus. They're interested in the possibility of the gospel, but because of the culture that they find themselves surrounded in, find it difficult to believe. And Tim Keller, in writing about Christians' relationships to doubts, he says, "A faith without some doubts is like a human body without any antibodies in it. People who blithely go through life too busy or indifferent to ask hard questions about why they believe as they do will find themselves defenseless against either the experience of tragedy or the probing questions of a smart skeptic. A person's faith can collapse almost overnight if she has failed over the years to listen patiently to her own doubts, which should only be discarded after long reflection," saying, consider why you believe what you believe. However, in another place he writes concerning doubt of the Christian faith, "The only way to doubt Christianity rightly and fairly is to discern the alternate belief under each of your doubts. And then ask yourself what reasons you have for believing that. How do you know your belief is true? It would be inconsistent to require more justification for Christian belief than you do for your own. But that is frequently what happens. In fairness, you must doubt your doubts. My thesis," he writes, "is that if you come to recognize the beliefs on which your doubts about Christianity are based, and if you seek as much proof for those beliefs as you seek from Christians for theirs, you will discover that your doubts are not as solid as they first appeared." So questions are not enough. You also need answers. You need reasons. But he's going to argue for a reasonable faith, which is what John has been arguing in this gospel. It is a faith based on evidence. It is a faith that is based on eyewitness testimony. But as we look at our text, we find that even some of those eyewitnesses themselves struggled with doubts. What do we do with doubters? It's a question that the early church struggled with. They very quickly discarded doubters. They lived in a time where the reigning empire might take you to task for faith in a Lord other than Caesar. It could cost you your money, it could cost you your status, it could cost you your very life. And early Christians were not keen on those who were not willing to suffer unto death for the faith. They would cast out doubters. You doubt, you're done. John, in the last chapter of a gospel meant to appeal to the one who is wondering about Jesus, to lead them to the conclusion that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and through belief that that one might have life in His name, turns his discussion to the doubters, the preeminent among the apostles. Peter, Thomas, the one who doubted the resurrection, and Nathanael, the one who had doubted the initial claims. And he leads us to ask the question, what do we do with doubt? Well, what would Jesus do? That is the question that John will move, or the answer that John will move to the question. Notice it, verse 4. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood on the beach. Yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. And so Jesus said to them, "Children, you do not have any fish, do you?" And they answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat and you'll find a catch." And so they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, John, said to Peter, "It is the Lord." And so when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, about 100 yards, dragging a net full of fish. And so when they got to the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid, and fish placed on it, and bread. And Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you've now caught." And Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land, full of large fish, 153. Although there were so many, the net was not torn. And Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." And none of the disciples ventured to question him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. And Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. Previously, we have noted John's use of light and darkness throughout the book. Jesus is the light. He is both the life and the revelation of God in a man. And we see then sometimes the time of day throughout the book is associated with this claim of who Jesus is and the people's response to him. So I think of Nicodemus in chapter 3, the teacher of Israel, who comes to Jesus by night. He knows that Jesus is sent by God, but he's not entirely believing yet. He doesn't want to be seen as being associated with Jesus yet. He's coming in doubt. He's coming in darkness. We see again with Judas's betrayal of Jesus. He goes out from the upper room to hand Jesus over to the Jewish and Roman authorities, and we read that it was night. Or even last week when the women come to the tomb to anoint the body of Jesus, we read that it was still dark. It was dark. They didn't believe. They weren't looking for a resurrection. Here in our scene, Jesus shows up at daybreak when light begins to shine. You know, the disciples, they're fishing at night. Here he is at daybreak, and the light begins to shine, and he's on the shore. But the disciples don't recognize him yet. We also saw this same phenomenon last week with the tomb. Mary didn't recognize Jesus. She thought he was the gardener. You see the same thing in Luke 24. On the road to Emmaus, some of Jesus' disciples are walking along, and Jesus pops up with them, and they don't recognize him. They don't see him for who he is yet. They're talking about the events. So Jesus has appeared. They don't recognize him, and we can't really blame them for that because they are about 100 yards off the shore at least, so they can't really see him very well. But he reveals himself nonetheless through another sign for the disciples. He does the exact miracle that we find in Luke's gospel, the miracle that he uses to call Peter. John doesn't mention it, but Luke does. Listen to this. This is Luke chapter 5, where we read that it happened while the crowd was pressing around Jesus and listening to the word of God, that he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. and he saw two boats lying at the edge of the lake, but the fishermen had got out of them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and he asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching the people from the boat. And when he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered and said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I'll do as you say and let down the nets." And when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. And so they signaled to their partners in the other boat for them to come and to help them. And they came and filled both of the boats so that they began to sink. But when Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet, saying, "Go away from me, Lord, for I am a sinful man." For amazement had seized him and all his companions because of the catch of fish which they had taken. And also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not fear. From now on you will be catching men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. "From now on you will be catching men." So they followed Jesus. Here we are at the end of John's gospel. They're not catching men. They're not even catching fish. They're just wasting time throwing nets in the water. I'm reminded of previously in John's gospel. In John chapter 15, you may recall Jesus' discussion to them about their relationship to him and the Father as one of the vine and the branches. He says, you guys are the branches, I am the vine. You can produce nothing on your own, therefore you must abide in me. Life is found in Jesus and is his word. And the illustration was meant to say that as long as you are acting in accordance with my word, you can produce fruit. You can produce life eternal for people who listen to your words. Because your words aren't your words, they're my words. And of course we know Jesus' words are the Father's words. He's sending them out with his words. So stick with the message. You depart from the message and you start adding works righteousness or any other kind of gospel to it, you've wrecked it. Here, they're out there fishing. They can't do anything on their own. They're not catching. They're not catching any fish. Jesus, according to his word, tells them, "Go out for a catch on this side." They do, and immediately they're catching more fish than they can deal with. What's the illustration? They can do nothing on their own, but if they listen to his word, "I'm going to make you fishers of men, fellas. And you stick with my word, you're going to get a catch." Of course, this is reminiscent, again, as we've mentioned, of Luke. It would have had great significance for Peter and James and John, since this was their first introduction to Jesus. And so he has revealed himself through this sign. And according to verse 7, John is the first to figure it out. I mean, he starts seeing the fish come and he says, "This is the Lord." But I love Peter's response. Recall, when it came to the empty tomb, the women came and they told him, "They've taken our Lord. We don't know what's happened to the Lord. He is gone." And so what happens? Well, they start a foot race. We got to go see. Peter and John go, but who gets there first? Not Peter. John says, "By the way, I outran Peter. I got there first. I looked in the tomb. I didn't go in. I looked in. I saw it first. I got there first." And then Peter, he caught up eventually. Not this time. This week, what do we find Peter? He's not going to wait to row the boat. We're not worried about the fish. I'm not worried about the boat. He's diving in the water. He's going to swim to Jesus. He's going to get there first. And so he does. And then the rest come to land. They find Jesus. He's waiting there with breakfast ready. We're told that this was the third of Jesus' resurrection appearances, evidently to the disciples. We saw the first one. Remember, the disciples are in a room locked up. He appears there, but Thomas isn't there. He does it a second time. Now this is the third time. We also know that he appeared to Mary at the tomb, but we're not counting that one. He appeared again. Why? Why do we need to know? Verse 15. "Well, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he said to him, "Tend to my lambs." And he said to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And he said to him, "Shepherd my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." Now, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that Jesus sets the pattern of wait until after breakfast to get down to business. No doubt if they had coffee in Judea, we would have waited. He wants them to be alert. Here we are. He directs our attention to Peter, who he asks three questions regarding his affection for him. And despite the way our translations appear, the question and answer sessions are not identical. They're different. Unfortunately, the English language only has one word for love. So in our culture, we say things like, "Love is love." But not the Greeks. The Greeks know better. They had three words for love. Eros, phileo, and agape. Now, eros, if I'm thinking of this word, it's what we might relate to romantic affections. You can hear it in some of our words. Erotic. That comes from eros. It's this sexual, romantic kind of love. Phileo, on the other hand, is what we would understand to be more of a brotherly affection. And y'all know this very well. I think of the city of Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. We're very familiar with that. And then there is agape, which gets an awful lot of play in Christian circles. We say it's the highest form of love. It's unconditional love. And we might be making more of it than the word actually supports, but it is akin to something of a cherishing. It is a deep-seated affection for someone else. What we find in our text are three questions, and they're not using the same words. First, Jesus, in verse 15, asks Simon, he says, "Simon, son of John, do you agape me? Do you agape me more than these other disciples do?" And Peter responds to Jesus, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." Very well, tend to my lambs. He says to him a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you agape me?" Peter says to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you." So he says, "Shepherd my sheep." Then he says to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you phileo me?" And Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you phileo me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I phileo you." And so he says, "Tend my sheep." What is going on here? You know, what's with the shift? Why is Peter, why is he asking him in the first place if he loves him? Why does he ask three times? Why is Peter grieved after the third time? Why is he shifting his words? I think of these questions, and I think many of them are answered with the last encounter that the disciples have with him prior to the cross. That long discourse that Jesus is explaining to them what they're to be about. I think of chapter 13, where Peter's denials were predicted. Listen to it. John chapter 13, verse 33. Jesus says to the apostles, the disciples, "Little children, I am with y'all a little while longer. You will seek me, and as I said to the Jews, now I also say to y'all, where I'm going, you cannot come. A new commandment I give to y'all, that you love one another. And love everywhere in the Upper Room Discourse is agape. It's only ever agape here. That you agape one another, even as I have loved you. That you also love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. And Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered, where I go? You cannot follow me now, but you will follow later. Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you. Jesus answered, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, a rooster will not crow until you deny me three times. Jesus says, this is the new commandment I'm leaving. Y'all need to love one another. Everyone will be able to recognize your testimony is true if you love one another. But he's leaving. Simon Peter, where are you going? Where is Jesus going? He's about to go to the cross. He's headed to the cross and then to the Father. He'll ultimately be at the Father, but he's going to the cross. Peter says, I'll follow you, Lord. I will lay down my life for you. Listen to the next statement. This is John 14, verse 12. Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to y'all, he who believes in me, the works that I do, he'll do also. And greater works than these he'll do because I go to the Father. Whatever y'all ask in my name, that I will do so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If y'all ask me anything in my name, I will do it. If y'all love me, y'all will keep my commandments. If you believe in me, you're going to do greater works than I'm doing. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments. Now listen to this one final one. Chapter 15, verse 12. Jesus says, this is my commandment, that y'all love one another just as I have loved y'all. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. Y'all are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call y'all slaves, for the slave doesn't know what his master is doing. But I've called y'all friends. For all things that I've heard from my Father, I've made known to y'all. Y'all didn't choose me, but I chose y'all and appointed y'all that y'all would go and bear fruit and that your fruit would remain so that whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he may give you. This I command y'all, that you love one another. They're his disciples. He commands them to love one another, and that love is demonstrated how? The willingness to lay down one's life for one another. Love one another unto death. Y'all are my friends. Greater love is no one than this. If you lay down your life for your friends. Jesus calls them friends, and then he goes and dies for them. Where are you going, Jesus? You can't follow me now, Peter. You will, but you can't right now. I'll lay down my life for you. No, you won't. Not this time. You'll follow me later. Now he's back. Jesus goes, he dies for his friends, he returns, he comes to Peter, and a question is on the table for Peter. Peter, do you love me? Do you love me? Yes, Lord. You know that I phileo you. Do you agape me though, Peter? Will you lay down your life for me, Peter? Peter doesn't have that same kind of confidence we saw in the Upper Room Discourse. Lord, I'll follow you right now unto death. No, he's had a taste of reality. He has seen and experienced something about himself when the time of testing came and it revealed where he was at. I don't know the man three times. I don't know the man. I don't know him. Now following the resurrection, Jesus has returned to doubting Peter, to denying Peter, to deserting Peter, to restore Peter, to set Peter back on track. So I think about that. I think I understand why Jesus asks Peter if he loves him, because he's about to call him to follow him and go to the same place that he was going. to death. I think I understand why he asks him three times, because Peter denied him three times. So with three denials, it has to be answered by three affirmations. I don't know the man. No, I do love you. I don't know the man. Yes, I love you, Lord. I don't know the man. Lord, you know that I love you. I understand that. Why is Peter grieved at the third question? Well, we might be tempted to say it's simply because that's what called to his memory, the fact that he denied Jesus three times. I'm not so sure. Why? Because John seems to tell us why he was grieved. And he doesn't say it's because Peter remembered that he denied Jesus three times. It says, verse 17, he was grieved because Jesus said to him the third time, "Do you phileo me?" That's why he was grieved. Jesus was asking, "Do you agape me? Do you agape me? I phileo you, Lord. I love you like a brother, Lord. Do you cherish me? Do you have a deep-seated affection for me? Do you have the love that I have commanded you to have for me?" In the upper room discourse, "Lord, phileo." Jesus brings it down a notch to phileo. "Well, then, do you phileo me, Peter?" Because he's just been telling him that he does. "Do you?" When Jesus says that, now that grieves him. He's grieved because the Lord now has changed it to what he's actually been telling him. "Do you really phileo me, Peter?" "Yes, Lord. Yes, I phileo you." Now, in response to Peter's confessions, with each time we have a commission. What in the world is this about? Here's this one who was wavering on the faith just a short time ago. He's commissioning him to tend my lambs, shepherd my sheep, tend my sheep. He's given him this special responsibility. What in the world is Jesus talking about? As you recall, we saw in the Gospel of John earlier, there was reference to the shepherd-sheep imagery. And Jesus claims to be the good shepherd. "Sheep hear my voice. I call them by name." And we noted that that's an Old Testament reference. It comes from Ezekiel, I think of, well, several places. You could have it Isaiah 40 as well. But Ezekiel, I think of Ezekiel 34, where the prophet is told to wear out Israel's leadership, the priests, because they're not taking care of the people. He says in Ezekiel 34:2, "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to those shepherds, thus says the Lord God, woe shepherds of Israel who have been feeding themselves, should not the shepherds feed the flock?" And then he goes through this long chapter wearing them out for the way that they've been fleecing the people and not caring for the people and enriching themselves at the cost of the people. He talks about how he's going to remove them because of that. "I'm taking away these bad shepherds." But then, after the negative, "I'm removing them," he gives the positive. This is in verse 23. He says, "Then I will set over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will feed them. And he will feed them himself and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken." So we find it there. You find the same thing in chapter 37. "My servant David," verse 24, "will be king over the people. They'll all have one shepherd. They'll walk in my ordinances. They'll keep my statutes. They'll follow my ways." So Jesus comes, you know, the religious rulers, the seminary professors and the pastors of the day are not teaching the people correctly. They're taking advantage of them. And that's why Jesus says, "You guys are thieves. You're robbers. The thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy. And that's what y'all do. That's why the sheep don't listen to y'all. You're on Satan's team." He presents himself as the good shepherd. But if Jesus is the shepherd and he feeds the sheep, why in the world is he telling Peter to tend the sheep and feed the lambs, to shepherd them? He's going away. Jesus is going away. He is leaving a stewardship to the apostles behind him. He's taking Peter, who denied him, and he's reinstalling him into his position. And now he's saying, in the same way that they're going to take his word out, they're also going to care for his flock, for him, on behalf of him, as his administrators. He's doing it, but he's doing it through his disciples. And so he tells Peter, "Shepherd my sheep." Now, as an extension of what's going to happen, we read in verse 18, Jesus tells Peter, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were younger, you used to gird yourself and walk wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will gird you and bring you where you do not wish to go." Now this, we read, he said, signifying by what kind of death he would glorify God. And when he had spoken this, he said to him, "Follow me." Now you get to follow me, Peter. When you're older, then you get to die. The same way, by the way, that Jesus died. Tradition has that Peter was stretched out and crucified, but he refused to allow himself to be crucified in the exact same way as the Lord, because he wanted to be lower than the Lord. So they crucified him upside down in Rome. But with this call to follow, it's been a heartbeat going throughout the book. We find it in the first chapter when the disciples are coming to check him out. Philip, you know, is this really the Christ? Jesus says to him, "You follow me." I think of chapter 10, which we just briefly mentioned in reference to the sheep, the people. Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice. I know them. They follow me." Chapter 12, verse 26, "If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there my servant will be also. And if anyone serves me, the Father will honor him." Or lastly, in chapter 13, where we just looked in this discussion with Peter, "Lord, where are you going? Where I go, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow later." Peter says, "Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I'll lay down my life for you. Will you lay down your life for me?" But now he's saying, verse 19, "You follow me." Now, when I think of this, notice Peter's response, verse 20. He turns around. He sees the disciple whom Jesus loved following them. He sees John, the one who also had leaned back on Jesus' bosom at the supper. And he says, "Lord," the one who said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" And Peter, seeing John, says to Jesus, "Lord, what about this man?" And Jesus says to him, "If I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? You follow me. What about this guy? What about that one? What about your other servants, Lord? I'm not concerned about it. It's about you and me, Peter. Does John have to die for you? That's none of your business, Peter." We see immediately, you know, the question. Here he is, he's set with his task. It's a question we all deal with, a question of envy or jealousy. You're in work. The worst thing that I was working at Subway many years back. I was a manager, and this guy hired a second manager from another store and their whole team. I said, "That's going to be problems." But all the same, he did it from another store. One of the first thing that other manager did is they post on the wall a schedule, but they were too lazy to go get a schedule that just had the time. They had a schedule that had everybody's pay rate on it. Yeah, imagine if you did that as a supervisor. You think that's going to cause cohesion? No! You've got fires everywhere. What about this one? What about that one? I want to make what they're making. Blew the whole place up. As Christians, we can fall into the same kind of trap. Oftentimes, we refer to it as legalism. What it really is we're saying, "I have a standard of how what it means to follow Jesus. You know, take up your cross and follow me." What that's really saying is, die to yourself, deny yourself, and count Jesus as preeminent, most important. Seek first His kingdom. But the question is, what does that look like? Well, it looks like the way that I do it. So I can look around and say, if you're doing A, B, C, and D that I don't think is okay, you know, well then, I'm pretty good. I'm better than that guy. Or if somebody else, you know, doing more than you, maybe you say, well, maybe I'm not there. What about this servant? What about that servant and how they're following Jesus? Don't worry about that. That's what's called relative righteousness. You know, you're looking around in this relative scale and trying to determine your relationship with God and the quality of your service. Am I doing enough? Do I have to go be a missionary in Asia to follow the Lord? You know, how much of my money do I need to tithe? What is the, you know, what's the level? Just how much I need to do to keep up with everybody else? No. Same thing with Peter. He puts blinders on like a horse in a race. Don't look at John. Don't worry about the others. I have plans for them. I'm talking to you, Peter. You follow me. You die for me. And it turns out it's going to be extremely important for almost every apostle to die. A martyr's death. John doesn't. All the rest do. That's critical. Why? Because it validates their testimony. You can die for something somebody else saw and something somebody else said. You can fly a plane into a building because of something somebody else saw or something somebody else said. It's an entirely different thing for you to claim something you saw and something you experienced and to die for that. So they need to die. They need to follow Jesus to validate their word. And he will. Now, this obviously caused confusion. We find John writing, "Therefore this saying went out amongst all the brethren that his disciple would not die." And yet Jesus didn't say to him that he wasn't going to die, but only if I want him to remain until I come. What's that to you? And this is the disciple who's testifying to these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things which Jesus did, which if they were written in detail, I suppose that even the world itself would not contain the books that would be written. So John says, don't get it twisted that he was saying he was going to come back before I die. That's not what he's saying. I mean, we're still waiting for him to come back today. He was just saying, that's none of your business, Peter. Don't you worry about that. Now, the question we have then is, did Peter get the message? Did Peter understand Jesus? Did he follow him? Well, I've already mentioned that he was crucified upside down for his faith. We find Peter writing in his first epistle this. Listen to it. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21. He says, y'all, these believers, have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for y'all, leaving an example for y'all to follow in his steps. Or chapter 5, verse 1, well, he will say, therefore I exhort the elders among y'all as your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, and a partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God among y'all, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, y'all will receive the unfading crown of glory. You see, he's been called to die. We'll find as much in his second epistle. He says, I know that I've got to die. Jesus already told me I got to die. Well, what's going to happen if he's shepherding the flock, tending the lambs, and he goes away? Same thing that happened when Jesus went away. He's going to have to entrust it to faithful men, those who are going to tend the flock in his stead. And it's going to go on, and it's going to go on. And the example has to be repeated and repeated and repeated throughout history until the day that Jesus comes. So the same standard of suffering presented by Jesus, the same standard of, let's use a different word, let's use Jesus' language, love. Greater love has no one than this, than he lays down his life for his friends. That same love, that same sacrificial mercy demonstrated by Jesus on the cross, that it was repeated by the apostles, is to be repeated and repeated by everyone that dons the pulpit, everyone that takes a position to care for the rest of the church, to teach the word, to point them back to Jesus so that they can have life in his name, to take John's words and then give it out. Did he get it? He got it. So what about us? Now, where do we set our affections? Do we love Jesus? Or perhaps the question should be, where do our loyalties lie? Faith is loyalty. Faithfulness. You can love your spouse and then commit adultery and go after, all kinds of other people. Not in that, but you can say, well, I love them, but I'm doing it. No. But you're not being faithful. you're not treating that relationship as holy and sacred and unique. Where do our loyalties lie? As most of y'all know, the former president has been indicted on 37 counts that range from mishandling of classified documents to obstruction of justice. At the same time, a whistleblower has emerged who says that there's an FBI file that links our current president, Joe Biden, to a criminal scheme involving money for policy decisions, pay for play, during his vice presidency. Now, depending on what side of the aisle that you're on, what commentators you're listening to, you may have been privy to certain conversations labeling the actions of one side or the other side as treason. This is treason. And then they call for the appropriate legal response to that. Now, in truth, neither the president nor the former president can be accused of treason, since neither of them can be shown to have assisted the enemies of the United States during wartime. That's the definition of treason. You got to be at wartime and your loyalties are lying with the opposing force. So you can't be accused of treason if you're not at war. But as Christians, we know that there is a war going on. Satan is the present ruler of the kingdoms of this world. And he wants to keep it that way. And although we live in his kingdom, our loyalties lie with another kingdom. The kingdom of our Lord and his Christ. We want to see his kingdom come. We want to see his will done on earth as it is in heaven. Or at least we should. We should be unhappy about this present state of things on planet Earth. We should be grieved over the present state of things in our country to the degree that it doesn't align with his kingdom, to the degree that it's not seeking his ways. And I'm not saying we're trying to change it so that the world is basically on palliative care. It should be screaming out that there's a problem, and we, as members of the coming kingdom, should be crying out the solution. Jesus, life is in his name. His kingdom's coming. So where do our loyalties lie? And if it came down to it, would Satan have enough evidence to convict us of treason? Are we followers of Christ? Are we committed to the cause? And what about those who doubt? What about when we doubt? I think of it as a loved one, but sometimes it hits closer to home. Well, according to the Apostle John, those who doubt find themselves in good company. Even the apostles doubted. And it's not just John that says this. Matthew, in the last chapter of his gospel, says, look, when they saw Jesus in his resurrected form, they worshipped him. But, verse 17, some doubted. Doubt is not the unforgivable sin. So what do we do with doubt? Well, what did Jesus do? He goes after them. He seeks them. He encourages them. He restores them. And if he did that for his apostles, and he is our example, then how much more so should we as we await his return?